Hi, dearly beloved podcast people. I'm Laura, and as you may have heard, I was lucky enough to receive an Izzy Award for Outstanding Achievement in Independent Media this year from the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College. As I always say, media is a plural noun. None of it is made alone. So I want to thank you for making it possible for us to remain independent. It's kind of a misnomer, actually. We're not dependent on killer corporations or politicians. We are dependent on you. So we treasure all of our donors, but none more than our sustaining members. You are the ones who reliably back us month after month, and you can join that precious fellowship for as little as $2 a month by going to patreon.com/The LF Show. That's also where you'll find the latest research material, all the stuff that I use to prepare the show, and films and videos and other things that we hope will allow you to dive deeper into each episode. I'll see you there over at the Patreon site. Now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Laura Flanders, and this is The Laura Flanders Show, the TV and radio program that seeks to raise radical spirits by interviewing forward-thinking people with real-life models of shifting power from the few to the many in the worlds of arts, entrepreneurship, and governance. This week on The Laura Flanders Show, we look at the women who are usually ignored in humanity's combat stories. What happens when you refocus the lens? We talk to two award-winning filmmakers behind the hit series Women, War, and Peace, which is now playing on public TV. That's all coming up on The Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Welcome. Women and conflict. It's time to take a closer look. What's actually going on in civil society in times of uprising and resistance? And what role are women especially playing? They may not make the news headlines, but that doesn't mean they're not making the news. In fact, they may be leading. They're probably leading in all sorts of ways the cameras rarely see. What forms do their leadership take? And to what effect? Questions like these are at the heart of Women, War, and Peace 2, a four-part film series that is streaming and playing on PBS stations. It started this Women's History Month. An all-female cast of directors presented four stories about women who risked their lives for justice and peace and changed history. We're pleased to have two of them here. Julia Basha, a Peabody and Guggenheim award-winning filmmaker and director of Nyla and the Uprising, of which more later, and Jeannie Redeker, an Academy Award-nominated and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker who directed The Trials of Spring and is also an executive producer of the series. Welcome both. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for
so
having us.
So it does have that two at the end, Women at War and Peace 2. Remind people, this is part of a series. There was a Women, War and Peace 1.
There was indeed.
What's the theme?
It was, Women in Conflict and Untold Stories. And I think that we kind of, Abby Dizzy and I did a film called Pray the Devil Back to Hell.
And I think that was the last time you were here on the show.
It is indeed. And it was the story of how women in Liberia, Muslim and Christian women, banded together to end a 14-year civil war. And we realized that that was just one of many, many, many stories. So we ended up doing a whole series. And I remember at the time that we were doing it, Pam Hogan was also one of the executive producers on it. She went to Paris, and she went to the War Museum in Paris, which is a museum that is an entire block long and three stories high. There was not one image of a woman in the entire museum. And so it's just we just feel like there's so many untold stories. So after we did the first series, we've now decided to come back with another one.
So are you halfway down the block, you think?
We have a long way to go.
Now, of course, Women, War, and Peace could mean kind of anything. I mean, your approach could be women who are victims, women who are peacemakers. How do you sort of play out the theme or unpack the theme a little bit more than that?
I think that we put women at the center of stories.
Yeah.
And so that it's there. I think too many stories are about women as victims. And that's like a very traditional way of looking at women. But what we found is that women in conflict tend to deal with things like who's eating what, what are people doing for water? What are people doing for schools? What in the whole kind of infrastructure is what women are left to handle and deal with. And so that they often have the best ideas about how to bring peace. So we just want to include them in the story.
Let's play the trailer for the series, and then we'll come to your film specifically, which I found so critically important. I can't wait to talk to you about it. But this is the trailer for the series, Women, War, and Peace 2. Check it out.
Survived Mubarak's rule, SCAF's rule, Morsi's government, and now back to a government backed by the army. And the same activists are being arrested and tried. It's not hard to remember what I wanted during the revolution, because what I wanted then is what I want now, freedom. The demands that were chanted sums it all up, red freedom and social justice, including fighting for women's rights specifically.
The British and Irish governments have announced a firm date for the start of all party negotiations on the Northern Ireland peace process.
We've got to do all of the things that we've been doing in our own lives as activists, but now we have to do them on the general political platform.
I'd never been in a political party before in my life. It wasn't politics, it was peace that I wanted.
We had to prove that it wasn't about sitting around a table and just talking about women's issues. It was about basic human rights issues for the whole of Northern Ireland.
Two of the films, the two of you were directly responsible, also in the directing of. Let's talk about Naila and the Uprising first.
Yeah, so I've been working for the past 15 years with a nonprofit organization called Just Vision, and we've been researching and documenting the work of Palestinians and Israelis who use nonviolent resistance to end the occupation and build a future of dignity and equality for both communities in the region. The films that we've had made up until Naila and the Uprising were all about contemporary stories of individuals who were taking tactics from civil disobedience strategies that have been used all over the world to try to create a better reality on the ground. And those activists who have been doing all of these actions over the past 10 years took their inspiration from what was done in the First Intifada in the late 1980s. So we had been hearing over and over again that they wanted to see the story of the First Intifada told for the first time on a feature documentary and see their stories and the movement that they built reflected in a motion picture.
So to take the American audience back, going back to the late 1980s, the image that most Americans would have would be of young Palestinian men throwing rocks at soldiers. And they might know that the uprising was sparked by the killing of several Palestinians at the hand of Israelis. In 88, 89?
December 1987 was when the uprising started in a refugee camp in Gaza, and it quickly spread to the East Jerusalem and the West Bank. As you said, most people will remember sort of this simple image of a Palestinian boy throwing a stone at a heavily armored Israeli tank. In reality, though, the First Intifada was this very well-organized and disciplined movement that involved all generations, that involved all of the Palestinian political factions, and involved women, actively so. When we started making the film, we were really wanting to tell the story about the nonviolent organizing that took place and the level of orchestration that took at the civil society level to maintain it for 4 years. What we didn't know, and we found out during the research, was that the reason why that had been such a disciplined and organized movement was because Palestinian women had been at the helm for much of it.
You tell the story of how many of the male men in leadership were actually deported, leaving women in charge, and in charge not just of strategy for the resistance, but of keeping people fed, of keeping people's lights on in a time which was also one of incredible economic conflict. Describe that part of the picture.
Yeah, during the early months of the uprising, as the community started really getting organized, and the Israeli military understood that this wasn't something that was going to pass in a few days, that this was different. This was an insurrection, was the word they were describing at the time. They knew they had to find a way to crush it really quickly. And they used sort of three main tactics. They did mass arrests of all young Palestinian men between the age of 14 and 24 that they found on the streets. And they had to set up these massive prison, makeshift prisons on the deserts in the south of Israel and the Negev in order to house all of these men because they couldn't fit under regular prisons. They also deported the sort of top leadership. And the way that these men were deported was very crude. They were put inside helicopters. The helicopters would fly out of Israel, would land in no man's land between Israel and Lebanon, and they would just be left there. And then the helicopter would fly away. And many of the men were killed as well. There was a lot of ammunition, live ammunition used against the protesters on the early months. And what happened was that a vacuum was left in their leadership, which was the intention of the Israeli army. What they didn't know was that there was a whole group of women who had been trained over now 10 years of community organizing, who were ready to take on the leadership and who were actually very prepared and had a vision for where they wanted to take the uprising.
And how common is this to the story that you've been telling across the series, in the sense that it is often into that vacuum that women's leadership emerges, even though women may have actually been filling that space for a long time?
Right. I think that it's our recognition of that, not the fact that women haven't been doing that, is actually that the media doesn't tend to look at those stories. And particularly around conflict, stories get to be told in terms of body counts and military battles. But actually, there's a whole lot of other things that happen during war. People continue to exist. And so I think that it's just that we don't look at those stories.
This is the Laura Flanders Show. I'm Laura. My guests are Jeannie Retica, executive producer of Women, War, and Peace 2, a series now running on public television. She's also executive producer and director of The Trials of Spring, a searing documentary about the Egyptian liberation struggle. Also with us, Julia Baca. She's creative director for Just Vision Media and director of the documentary Nyla and the Uprising. You can watch their trailers and the series trailer at www.lauraflanders.org. That's also where you can subscribe to our podcast to receive studio extras that you won't hear here. The latest of those is Citizen Inc., featuring Atossa Araxa Abrahamian, senior editor at The Nation, on the buying and selling of citizenship. Next, what happens to all the extraordinary women's leadership that kicks into action in wartime and was almost invisible in corporate coverage of Palestine, for example? To take us there, here's a taste of composer Blake Lay's film score for Jeannie Retica's The Trials of Spring. And a tidbit on Blake, his credits include films by Spike Lee, Julie Taymor, and HBO's acclaimed series, The Wire.
Thank you.
often we think when we talk about keeping society together being important, we think of it as separate from the conflict or the work of peace and justice making. I think what I got from the series and what I particularly get from your film, Julia, is that it is the peace and justice making. And in this case, it was actually the survival mechanisms that the women put in place that almost won the conflict.
That's right. The Palestinian women at the time, they had a vision for how to start putting together the structures that could lead to an independent Palestinian state. And those structures included things like healthcare for the community. So instead of relying on the hospitals that were controlled by the Israeli military, they actually set up mobile clinics to take care of people independently and not in a way that would put in danger the well-being of injured people coming into hospitals. It means making sure that people are fed. And so in order to actually build independence from Israeli products, which the Palestinian communities were a captive market for the goods coming from Israel, they actually established a boycott of Israeli goods and started setting up victory gardens, which were gardens in people's backyards
where they would grow,
and cooperatives where they would grow tomatoes and eggplants and start distributing it. All of that, by the way, was illegal. And you could be put in prison for 10 years for doing any of these activities. Similarly, education, another core aspect of establishing a state and your independence. They wanted to be have their own educational systems. Israel had shut down the Palestinian schools. And so they started teaching Palestinian kids inside their homes. If you were found with more than 3 kids inside your living room and books were present, you could be in prison for 10 years because of that act. So they were taking enormous risks while really creating and reimagining what it means to be part of a society and building equality for women inside of that society.
Let's talk about Trials of Spring. Not unrelated. I mean, one of the connecting points there was, again, how do we provide a service that people need that also liberates people? In this case, people in protest trying to defend themselves against assault and rape. Do you want to just introduce Trials of Spring a little bit and how you found your central character?
Sure. Trials of Spring is basically the story of Hend Nafeo, who is a young woman from a village in Egypt who's a very conservative family. She kind of sneaks out of the house and begins to take part in the demonstrations that we all know as Tahrir Square during the Arab uprising. And her family had no idea that she was participating until she got arrested and beaten and tortured. And then they came to get her and then proceeded to punish her for taking part in all that. And the charges that were against her then continue on through the courts for 3 years. And her story is really a microcosm of what happened to Egypt. Because during the early days, it was just this incredible euphoria that people talked about, like being in Tahrir Square and feeling like there were one organism, that there was incredible unity. And that really begins to split on International Women's Day, which unfortunately women went down to Tahrir Square to demonstrate for women's rights, which was only a month after Mubarak fell. And immediately they got pushback. And the pushback came not only from Islamists, but came from some of their fellow demonstrators, and it was get out, get out, get out, get out. And it was at that moment that the army decides that they're going to break up all the protesters. And so the Hand's story very much parallels what happens in Egypt.
Let's check out the clip.
Now that Mubarak stepped down, what's your first wish? And I was like, end sexual harassment. Every Egyptian woman can be assaulted at any time. And all what prevails is impunity. Mubarak's rule, SCAF's rule, Morsi's government, and now back to an interim government backed by the army. And the same activists are being tried and arrested. It's not hard to remember what I wanted during the revolution, because what I wanted then is what I want now, freedom. Who doesn't want freedom?
What happened to Hend?
Hend eventually was tried in absentia for the demonstration that she took part in and sentenced to life in prison. because she was tried in absentia, she was able to leave the country before she was brought in, and she's now living in the United States. And so she is, and still working very much on behalf of other people in Egypt. And the number of people that have gone into prison since Sisi took power is now 60,000 people, are human rights defenders, are in jail. So the situation in Egypt has gotten much, much worse.
And Naila?
Naila lives in Ramallah with her husband, Jamal Zakut, and her son Majd is in Canada. So Majd is a baby when the First Intifada is taking place, and he ends up actually having to go into prison with her when Naila is arrested because he's an infant and he's still breastfeeding and felt very ill when she is captured and held for 6 months in prison. And he is now a lawyer in Canada. And Naila is still very active on women's issues as well as national liberation issues.
And how does she and her cohort that you depict in the film make sense of what happened after the First Intifada, after the Madrid talks, the Oslo Agreement, and the civil society organizations that they had created more or less being written out of the picture?
Yeah. The First Intifada, after about 3 years, created a political space internationally and in the United States that we have not seen since then. So what happened was that by the time that the protests had kind of achieved its full potential and there was a lot of organizing, a lot of pressure against the attacks that the Israeli army were committing against protesters, George Bush Sr., who was the president at the time, did something that no president in the United States has done since, and no president had done up until him, which is that he threatened to withhold loan guarantees from Israel. Loan guarantees are one of the ways that the United States has for decades now provided financial assistance to Israel. So he threatens to withhold that financial assistance unless Israel stops building settlements in the West Bank. Settlements are the illegal transfer of a civilian population into occupied territories, a violation of international law. And for decades, the United States has been financially supporting that effort. George Bush was the first one to say, if you want our contributions to your country, you need to stop violating international law. And that created momentum for the first peace agreement to take place. So this was the first time that Palestinians were invited to negotiate directly with Israel, as opposed to in prior negotiations like the Camp David Accords, where Palestinians were represented by Jordanians or by Egyptians because they weren't considered a nationality. They were just Arabs that could be folded into a Jordanian nation or an Egyptian nation.
But Naila wasn't invited to the table.
Naila wasn't invited, but her colleagues were. So the first negotiation in Madrid, which marked the beginning of that process, actually included many Palestinian women, including Zahira Kamal. And those women kind of created a blueprint for what could be a real future of independence and freedom for the Palestinian
population. People were very excited.
Then that negotiation process was undercut by a secret negotiation between Israel and the PLO, which was at the time based in Tunisia, and had become concerned that they were losing their political power over the Palestinian cause because so many of the Palestinian leaders from the West Bank and Gaza were now representing the Palestinian cause directly on the international stage.
So in flies Bill Clinton to the not rescue. People will have to see the film to get the full story. I urge you to watch it on public television or stream at the website. Conclusions from this. Do you have any about sort of biologically determined roles for women or otherwise? Are you trying to make a point? Women better, men not so good?
No, I'm not trying to make that point at all. I think that women being absent is bad for all of us, and that women have something different to bring to the table. They have different points of view. It's not biologically better, and it's kind of like, I kind of even don't like getting into that discussion because it's not really, it's a proven fact that when women are part of a negotiating table, that the peace will last longer. It's also that the signs of democracy are the greater representation that women have, which is kind of obvious since we're 50% of the population, the greater democracy will be. And so those are just, they're just the way that it is. And so we wanted to tell those stories.
Julia?
I think that it's really critical for the future generations of young women that they get to see the stories of the women who actually have led movements historically around the world represented on the screen, because we are now seeing a resurgence of women's activism around the world and including the United States. And we need to learn lessons from what worked, what didn't. The fact that a Palestinian movement was undercut and now we're left with the ongoing injustices in the region is something that we need to learn from. Why did that happen? Let's not let that happen again. Let's build political power while we are doing our grassroots movements so that we can actually create long-term, sustainable, democratic countries.
All right. The series, the second series, Women, War, Peace 2, is airing and streaming at PBS. I want to thank you both for coming in. It's great talking to you. And I can't wait to see the rest of the series.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Jeannie Redeker, executive producer of Women, War, and Peace 2, the documentary series now running on PBS. She's also the executive producer and director of The Trials of Spring, one of the films we've been talking about. With her was Julia Basha, director of Naila and the Uprising. You can find information on all my guests and more about the series, along with links and related articles, at our Patreon site. Come join our Patreon pals at patreon.com/TheLF Show. That's patreon.com/TheLF Show. While you're there, become a member. By doing so, you keep this podcast independent and ad-free. Thank you. And thanks to the Park Center for Independent Media for honoring me with a 2019 Izzy Award for Outstanding Achievement in Independent Media this year. You can sign up for our newsletter and hear more about it, and even attend the award ceremony if you fancy, if you happen to be in Ithaca on Monday, April 15th. It's free and open to the public. More information at lauraflanders.org. This show is produced by yours truly, Laura Flanders, with Monica Mohapatra, Charlotte Carpenter, Nat Needham, Natasha Gaspar, Jeannie Hopper, Joanna Pinto, and Dominic Marcella. The Laura Flanders Show is made possible from the Novo, Ford, Tomcat, Cloud Mountain, and Fonda Foundations, as well as by listeners like you. So thank you. Stay kind, stay curious. Until the next time, I'm Laura.
The poison of corporate-controlled information is pervasive within the American media landscape, which makes the Laura Flanders Show one of the most important places that we can go to understand how power works, the reality around us, and how to resist. This is Chris Hedges, and I listen to the Laura Flanders Show.